Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today. We're going to have Urban Laszlo tonight, and we're going to talk about his book, well, one of his book, The Akashic Experience, but most importantly, we're going to talk about his message to the young people. We're at the end of 2012 and starting up a new year with new hopes and dreams, everyone. And so we have a message that we would like to say to the young people today. How are you, Irving?
I'm fine, Eva. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I know it's a big time difference between the two of us. Before we get started, though, I would like for you to take a little bit of time and tell people, you know, where they can find you, where your website is, about the Club of Budapest and the other things that you're doing so that they will know how they can get connected to other people like themselves to help make a change in the world today.
Well, I have founded the Club of Budapest in 1993, and it has a group of people in different parts of the world that can become members and they can jointly create some ideas, get together. And this is now an ongoing enterprise in 17 countries of the world. You can always reach it at theclubofbudapest.org. Or you can have my own website where you get all the information on the various activities that I have, which is my name, Irving Laszlo, in one word, .com. I should add that I have a new book coming out dealing with these things. I mentioned the Akashic Experience. I have a new book just now on the internet, which is The Akasha Paradigm. And it's in two versions. There's a short version, which a lot of video clips write in it by Marion Williamson, by Deepak Chopra, Ed Mitchell, and others. And there's a full version, a regular ebook, which is called The Akasha Paradigm in Science. And you can access both of these if you look at Akasha Paradigm, that's with a K, Akasha Paradigm in one word, .com. So that's as basic information. And my real interest, my strongest interest at the present time, is to highlight the basic principles of a different paradigm based on non-locality, based on consciousness in the world, connect these ideas with science, with quantum physics. I know that these are the kind of things that Eva, you yourself are very much into, very much interested in. So my attempt is to show that there is a foundation that even as a necessity for changing, for shifting the paradigm. The book that I'm just completing is called The Next Scientific Revolution. And I'm trying to outline why this revolution is coming and that we need to move from what I call a local state paradigm, that everything is just happening in one place, isolated from all the others, except through some causal phenomena, classical mechanics, to a new non-local paradigm where everything is basically entangled, so there are no absolute distinctions. Nothing is absolute in one place, in one time, because everything is intrinsically and inherently connected to all other things. That, of course, has a very major implications for our knowledge of the world, for our mind, for our consciousness. So I'll be happy to talk about any of these aspects that you like.
You have so much that's important, Irvin. You sent me an article the other day that literally almost brought me to tears because when I read it, it's the truth. And our children don't know that. The average person doesn't understand about materialism and how we can't stay sustainable forever. In fact, our grown-ups don't know that either in many places in the world. So maybe if we could talk about this position of materialism and what we need to do to change it, because our world's not going to stay the way it is for very long if we don't.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. That's a recognition.
So I'd just like maybe start with that, the message to the young people.
Well, I start with a simply controversial message. I mean, most young people feel that they are in a rather poor situation. You are at the tail end of one world, and you don't not very clear where you are moving on to the next one, and what is going to happen, and what kind of future they will have. I start with a quite controversial claim quite the opposite. I say that to young people, you are the most privileged, the most fortunate generation in the world, because never before has there been a generation that had the opportunity and actually the power of ideas, the power of changes in behavior, changes in mentality, to actually create a change in the world, which could be a transformation, a fundamental change, and that which can occur in the scope of a matter of years, very fast. We are now at the cusp of the one age, and we're moving into the next one, and we are in this transition period where there can be so many things that we call butterfly effects of where a small group of people, as Margaret Mead has said, can change the world. And the young people today can be that group of people. Of course, if all the young people would get together, that certainly would create an immediate tremendous change. But even smaller groups of people who are really open to the future, who are really open to thinking in different terms, recognizing that what we have today is basically living an old paradigm, an old way of looking at the world, of acting in the world. And that has become unsustainable, that has become crisis-prone, and it is about to break down. So this enormous change, this enormous opportunity of creating...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, go ahead.
No, I thought you'd finished. Do you know of a place where young people can collectively gather on cyberspace so they can try to pull forces together? Because I have a lot of college-age people that write me and say, I want to help change the world, but I'm the only one in my group or the only one in my school or my neighborhood. Are there any like-minded people? Is there a place for them to do that you know of?
Well, you know, I did a radio show of 90 minutes just a day before we are doing this program, and that's where 100,000 people were linked to that, you know, and this is called Humanity's Team. That's one of the places. There are many places like this, and they are extremely keen on bringing people together and allowing them to participate in thinking about oneness, about the world. So this is one of the things. There's also the SHIP network, you know, which is creating a series of things. I'll be doing a webinar for them in the spring. There's also the Giordano Bruno University, which is creating online programs, academic accredited degree programs for young people based on this new paradigm where people can enroll in these programs. And there's, of course, then the Club of Budapest itself. I'm going to create now with my colleagues, with my friends, a center for advanced study, which is going to be located in Princeton, New Jersey, which is going to be called, they decided to call it after me, the Irvin Laszlo Center for Advanced Study. And this should be coming online in the next couple of months. And we hope to create a forum where young people can come together and exchange ideas and develop this new paradigm.
That's a wonderful thing. What was the organization where you said people could study and take classes, young people?
Yes, the Giordano Bruno University is one of several. As chancellor, it's an online university. It doesn't really have a physical location. It's not a brick and mortar on campus. You know,
I don't understand how to spell it.
Well, it's named after the founders, perhaps the most important founder of modern science, together with Galileo. In fact, he knew Galileo. They took together Giordano Bruno. That's Giordano, and his last name was Bruno. Bruno. So Giordano Bruno was this fantastic heretical scientist who managed who dared to stand up to the Vatican, to the Inquisition in those days in the 16th century. And in fact, in the year 1600, he was a martyr. He was burned alive in Rome at the Campo di Fiore, which is still remembered for that. His statue is still there because he did not admit that the church at that time, which says this is a finite universe and the earth is the center of everything. And Bruno said, no, this is an infinite universe and there are many solar systems, there are many forms of life in it, and earth is one of them. So he created a basis for thinking pragmatically about the universe, and he gave his life for that. So the university is named Giordano Bruno University, and you can find it GiordanoBruno.com, GiordanoBrunoUniversity.com. You'll find the information right on the web.
So we have 7 billion people on the planet, Irvin. How do we continue to have babies? Should people look at birth control, or can the Earth sustain that many more people at the population rate that it's growing? Can our natural resources support that? How do we know? How do we convince our children and the other people, their parents, that don't know that we must have a change? Does that make sense?
I think artificially controlling birth is the answer. I think birth control comes about naturally, voluntarily by people when they reach a certain level of safety, security in their lives, so that they know they don't depend on more and more children to be able to support them in old age or work around the house or on the farm or wherever. I think that's a natural demographic curve. When the level or standard of living goes up, the rate of fertility usually goes down and it stabilizes. And the normal thing is replacement. You have as many children coming into the world as many as people, old people who die and leave the world. And that's a normal thing. And that's a healthy thing. I think most animals live in this kind of a natural balance between input and output, maintaining themselves. In any case, what I want to add is not the number of people that is the problem for the resources of the Earth. It's the per capita consumption of those resources. If we were living in a very modest way, we could easily have 9-10 billion people in the world and supplying them with resources for life. But we are having tremendous appetite. Just look at how much energy we are using, how much minerals we are using up in the world, how much water we are using, you know, and everything we do, even in a pound of beef that we eat, how much hundreds of gallons of water are being used for that.
So take a minute and do what you need to do. It's okay.
Yes.
Do you need to clear your throat? It's okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Sorry?
I drank some water.
Okay, good. It's okay to do that. Sorry. I don't mind. So
beyond
what about our healthcare system? How do you believe that we need to change our healthcare system? Personally, I follow a line of alternative medicine and prevention of disease and early detection. Do you think that plays an important role in the future of our society and allopathic medicine and pharmaceuticals?
The new system is also the old system. I'm told that in ancient China, you paid your doctor as long as you were healthy. When you were sick, it was his job to cure you. You know, you didn't pay for him. You paid him for keeping you healthy. And that's the whole idea of preventive medicine. We ought to concentrate on staying healthy. And that means staying natural, using all the natural means that are available. The more we use these synthetic means, these allopathic means, the more we create a balance in one part of the body at the cost of a disbalance someplace else. We are manipulating a natural system, which is so complex that we can't possibly manipulate it. We can cure somebody, it's an emergency. We have a tumor that has to be sometimes excised, it has to be cut out, yes. But for ordinary caring, preventive medicine, use something natural. I myself have not had any allopathic medicine in my life now, probably close to 30 years. If necessary, I take something homeopathic, but I'd use natural thing. I try to get my natural intake of the minerals, of the vitamins, and I try to stay in balance with the world around me. I'm also working with healers like yourself who are clairvoyant, who knows what goes on in the body, how to rebalance, but if something is going wrong before it shows up as sickness. So there are quite different ways, as you yourself are practicing, to keeping healthy rather than artificially bombarding ourselves with synthetic materials.
I totally agree. It's one of my passions. So let's talk about quantum entanglement and mind and intention for just a little bit. If the butterfly effect is real, then that means that thought can manipulate reality. Do you believe that?
I don't think that what we consider thought is actually creating something in the world. I think it's interacting. But we have to go back, you know, from here and define what we mean by thought, because the thought is an element in consciousness.
That's so true. You're true.
What is consciousness?
Yeah, that I should have started that at the very beginning, because, you know, that's what my new book, of which you are a chapter, is about. That thing, consciousness, everybody fights over what is that. Well, they don't even know to fight over that thing. They just fight because they don't have a meaning of the mind and don't know it. So what is that thing? What is consciousness? Let's start there.
I think this universe, this cosmos, is psychophysical, if you like to use it in a single term. It means it has a psychological aspect and a physical aspect. I think both of them are present. I think of myself as of you or of any human being as having as a mental, a psychological aspect, a spiritual aspect, which is just as basic, just as fundamental, if not more so, than the physical aspect. And this is not, they are not separate things. They are just the way we approach it. You know, there's this famous theory in quantum theory, which I'm sure you know, which is called the complementarity principle. Depending on how you set up an experiment, you find that a quantum is either a particle or a wave. And actually, it's both. But you don't see both of them at the same time. The same kind of complementarity arises and exists when you deal with consciousness. If you look at the phenomenon of mind and you look at it in other people, you don't see mind, you don't see consciousness, you see brain. You see neurons firing in complex sequences, and then you see certain kind of behaviors resulting, which you assume are resulting from that. And again, when you look at your own consciousness, introspect on your consciousness, then you don't see anything that would be outside that consciousness, because even when you look at somebody else's brain, neurons, everything is just a phenomenon, something that's appearing in your consciousness. So I don't think you can mix the two things. They don't appear at the same time.
So let me ask you a question, because I understand what you're saying, but to many people, they don't understand. Like my brother, for example, if he hears all of the words you just said, it's over his head. So can I ask you some questions that brings it down to a kindergarten level? Consciousness, I think I understand what you're saying, that consciousness is everything that is, and it also includes awareness. It includes the ground of all being, or the irreducible unit. Is that what you're saying? And then there's a separate thing called mind, which we can't see, that is separate from brain. Is that right so far?
I want to make a distinction between mind and consciousness. Mind and consciousness are separate from brain. Yes, that is a major distinction. One is a physical phenomenon. The other one is a psychological, a spiritual phenomenon, if you like.
And I call big mind the source of intentionality, and I call little mind that thing that races across, you know, in my thoughts every day. Do you have a way to describe the difference between big mind and little mind? Ego, maybe? Ego and big mind? I don't know how to better say that. I don't have the language.
I don't know exactly, you know, how we'd have to talk about it some more to find out exactly what we mean. There is such a thing as consciousness in the world. The famous scientist Erwin Schrödinger said that it's a mistake to say consciousness in the plural. You know, think of that. He says there's only one consciousness, and we all participate in that one consciousness. It's almost like saying there's only a divine consciousness, and we're all part of that divine consciousness.
Go ahead.
That there is a cosmic consciousness, which is the consciousness that's in the universe, that's inherent in the universe. And in our individual mind, in our individual being, we have a display of that consciousness. Let me give you here a sort of a metaphor for that, or a story. There is a famous legend in India, which is called Indra's net. Indra, Indra's net. That's supposed to be a famous king in ancient times. And in his castle, there was a net hung up, hung a net. And this net had many jewels. Some say they were pearls, others say they were jewels. But this had a very curious property. Every jewel or every pearl in that net reflected all the other pearls. So each one contained, in a way, all the other things. And that, in a sense, is how we participate in this cosmic mind, the divine mind, if you like, or cosmic consciousness. We are all reflecting that overall consciousness, that overall mind, and we are all have a part of it, a segment of it, which is in displayed, like we would have a little monitor inside our head. We are displaying on our internal monitor that overall consciousness, which is the consciousness of the whole universe.
Okay, let's take a moment and address a few statements to the scientist. Because I interviewed probably in my new book, again, I want to say the name of it is called Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Science of Quantum Mechanics. And basically what I found when I did that interview is I interviewed 50 or 60 people, scientists, all scientists that you would know and would respect. And I'm not going to name any names, but you would know them. So I would ask one scientist, what is your definition of consciousness? And his answer would be awareness. I would ask another one. His answer would be, oh, it's the opposite of being in a coma. Another one would literally be, consciousness is awareness that you are aware. Another one would be zero point field. Another would be ground of all being. Another one would be the irreducible unit. So if that is a fact, and it is, because I have the interviews where people say things like that, then we have a bridge to gap. You know, imagine all of you being at a table trying to put together a model of physical reality, and we're using that word consciousness. And the man sitting next to you defines it as one of those alternate ways that I just described. How do we fix that? That's what my book is about. How do we fix that? Because we will never move forward if we don't fix that.
You can fix differences once you have agreed on the basics. The basics are what they call known in science as primitive terms. They are not derived from anything else. You have to. Einstein said that also very clearly. You have to start with something, and you probably start with your intuition. Once you define your basic terms, what you think is the basic nature of reality, for example, if you put that down on the table, then we can fix up differences. We can argue about, you know, whether this is follows correctly or not. But your basic intuition, these basic philosophical intuitions, they are almost like theological arguments, you know. They are almost saying which is right, you know, the Brahman concept of the universe or Moses' concept or Abrahamic concept of the universe. These are such basic issues. I don't think you can make, you can decide.
I think one of the problems is, though, Irvin, when I would talk to these people, they all have this different definition. That Amit Goswami said to me, oh, my God, Eva, I had no idea that the man sitting next to me had a different definition. Bill Tiller said the same thing. He called me a month ago and said, I love your book. It's one of the most important books I've ever read. Then he called me back and said, I hate it. And I went, why? And he said, because everybody else doesn't say the same thing I do. And I went, but that's what's so important, Bill, is that you're all using this word, and you all mean something different by it, but you don't tell each other that you mean something different, so you have an argument. If we put it out on the table that we define it differently, then we could all have a meeting of the minds that we're talking about something else.
Well, and I can give you my definition of consciousness, okay? I define it as the qualitative flow of sensations that accompanies your even waking or even sleeping moments all through your life. It's a flow of sensations and its qualities. It's sounds, it's colors, it's images. It's all of these things are very different from the scientific definitions of quantum and atom and everything else. You know, it's a flow of sensations. It's there. It is there in me. I don't know if it's there in you or in anybody else because I can't directly inspect your consciousness. Nobody can. This consciousness is private. This is what was said. I have my consciousness. I think of it as my readout. If you say like in a readout, like a, my internal monitor, the way mm-hmm. the world appears to me, that is my consciousness in qualitative sense. Then you have to ask, how is this flow of sensations related to the brain, related to the world? And then you enter into the complexities of the argument.
So from now on, when you, I'm just asking you this a question, when you talk to other scientists, will you tell or just talk about the point that, hey, let's make sure we're on the same page when we use this word? What do you mean by that thing, Dr. So-and-so, so that we can bridge this gap? Just, I don't know if that makes any sense, but Bill Tiller actually called me back and he said, you know, Eva, I've been thinking for a week, is the problem me or is it you? And he said, I've decided that the problem was me, that I thought everything and everybody should think the way I did, and I didn't realize that people were thinking other things when they used the definition of this word. He said, I realize I need to come back out of retirement and talk to other scientists and let them know, hey, the reason that we're fighting is because we're talking about different things and don't know it. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, it does, but it's not unique to consciousness's mind. I mean, you don't have a basic understanding among in scientists about what matter is, for example, or energy is, you know, or space, or time. We don't have a single definition that everybody can agree to all these things. The universe of science is one that we are trying to understand a very complex phenomenon, which we call the world around us. We're trying to understand how that is put together, and from the elements that we experience ourselves. You know, Einstein said it very nicely. Science is an attempt to tie together the facts that we observe in a comprehensive and consistent scheme. Just make some sense of it. But this has been tied together all through these centuries in different ways. It is being tied together in different disciplines today. There is a consensus, I think, on the main elements of how the world is structured. But when you ask what is the world, what is consciousness, I don't think you have a consensus.
Yes, but I don't think the scientists understand that they're not on the same page, that they even have a difference. That's what I've found.
Well, when you push this question, then scientists will say, but you are doing philosophy. This is now not science. Science is not what, science is how, you know. And that's, of course, a self-limitation on science. But the question of what I'm very interested, but then I'm a philosopher as well as a scientist. I'm very interested in the what question. And I'm always willing, and I do define what I mean by things, by what I mean by matter, what I mean by consciousness, what I mean by space and time. I do that in my books. But I don't expect, nor can I expect, that everybody unanimously will give the same definition.
So do you believe that we live in a holographic environment?
In a holographic, you say?
Yes, sir. Like a virtual reality?
Oh, boy. Well, it's we have to take that apart, that element. I think the field in that connects us is a holographic field. But now we're entering into a particular theory, which is my theory of the unified field, or some people call it the zero-point field. I call it the Akashic field. You know, I believe that that field is an informational field, which is like the software of a computer. The software of the computer is a single system where all elements are connected with all other elements, you see. What you write on the computer is governed by that system, but it can be something else. You can write very different things, and you can sometimes disagree about the things that you write. But the software is the same. So I think the universe has a software, has a logic, This is where all the fields and all the forces and all the elements of that make up a universe, the so-called physical constants, these are all in that software. This universe is the way it is because of that software. I call it the Akasha, the dimension that the ancient Hindus 5,000 years ago called the most fundamental dimension, the Akasha dimension. So that's why I call it the Akasha. But you can call it, if you like, you know, the hidden dimension. You can call it the divine dimension, if you like, or simply the mysterious ultimate dimension, whatever. It's been called different kinds of things. The main thing is to recognize that what you observe in the world is not that. What you observe is the effect of that.
Okay.
The real thing, and there is the manifestation of the thing. We are dealing with our senses. We are dealing with the manifestation.
So my next question would be, if that's the way it is, then can we change our, how do we use that to change our lives? Just every day, let's say a veteran that comes back from Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever it is, and he's walking around in misery every day thinking about what he saw in Iraq. He's creating that reality in the moment because he's living in the past. Can he change that reality?
We change our conception of it. We are all, at every given time, creating our own conception of reality. I don't think we are actually changing the reality by changing our conception. We are interacting with that reality. So therefore, how we think of that reality obviously has an effect on that reality. Because I do think that our consciousness, yes, definitely our consciousness is interconnected with the consciousness of other people, which I just said, that if our consciousness is like Indra's net, is a display of the divine, our cosmic consciousness, of course, it's like in a hologram. I mean, just bear with me for one moment. You know, in a hologram, we know that every information that makes a hologram is present in every small bit of that hologram. So if you illuminate any small part of a holographic film, you get the entire image. It's known as a distributed information field. So the same in our mind, whatever is in this divine or cosmic consciousness appears in your consciousness, and you interact with the rest. In that sense, I think your consciousness as being a part of the whole consciousness is changing the whole consciousness, and the whole consciousness is all the time acting on your consciousness. There's an interaction.
Do you believe that we have free will? And when I say that, I mean there's a difference between having free will and complete free will. If we had free will, then nothing bad would ever happen to us. So can you tell me what your thoughts are on free will, complete free will? Because everybody says, I have free will, I can do anything that I want. Do you think
I don't think, if the universe is interconnected, these are very basic questions. If there is connection in the universe, that everything is connected with everything else, which is something that I strongly believe is really the case, then it follows that you cannot have complete free will. Why? Because you remain connected. You're never disconnected. Think of a die, that you're rolling a die, you know? That die can never roll entirely freely from the rest because it is gravity. It touches the surface of the table, everything else. It remains connected. So the die's roll is not entirely random. Free will would be something that's entirely random because it's disconnected from the rest. Only you or the agent, himself or herself, decides what is free will. But if that individual, the subject, remains connected, then it cannot be completely free. It can be relatively free. It can decide how to respond to its connections. It can create a different kind of connections. Yes, it is a free agent in that sense, but it's not completely free because it's not separate from the rest of the world.
So, Irwin, you are a very active human being with governments in the world and other societies. Can you tell me how are your positions being received or received by other governments? I mean, do they believe you?
Well, it's a very
remarkable. Are they willing to make differences to change our world?
I think it does, yes. I think I am making a difference. I think so.
Oh, I know you are, but what I want to know is, how do they receive you? How does the President of the United States receive your information? Does he believe it? It's not just you. I mean, it's the scientists that support you and you. Do they believe it?
I'm reminded here of a saying by Gandhi. He said that's very, when you innovate, people will first ignore you, then they'll criticize you, and then they say, hey, yes, it's true, but we have known it all along, you know? So I'm moving now from the phase, I'm past the phase of being ignored. I'm being, to some extent, criticized, but also a number of people are now, even more people are saying, aha, yes, I've known that. I've thought of that like that, you know?
So that makes me happy.
that's the best phase, I think, to get into.
I went through that same stage in my own small life, you know. At first, my family thought I was crazy, and then they wouldn't talk to me and criticize me. Now my brother says to me, because I grew up in a fundamental religion. I'm not going to say which one. And my brother said, and then I had a spontaneous enlightenment back in about 95. My brother says, oh, the devil's in you. You know, something's wrong with you. You need to get help. But now he says, he calls me like a month ago. We haven't talked in probably 8 years. And he calls me. He goes, Sissy, I believe you now. I'm dying of a heart problem. My heart's falling apart. But I see on the Science Channel all the stuff you've been saying, all these for the past 2 decades. And now that I'm dying and I've been forced to reevaluate my life, I see that you were telling me the truth. And I wish I had just listened 10 years ago. So, I mean, it's coming to the state where people are going, yes, I know that. I know
that. That's what's happened to me. You know, I've started writing about these things. First of all, about the new paradigm, a new way of thinking about the world. Then about the world that is not sustainable, we need to change. I started this maybe 35, 40 years ago. And at first it was, what it seems to me now, is so far ahead of its time that people could simply ignore it, say that, you know, what are you talking about? That's nonsense. Or not even say that, but simply just ignore it. And now the world is changing, and the world is moving in that direction where, first of all, the facts of the world, the coming crisis, the unsustainability, the transformation that is happening in front of our eyes, you know, that's showing that some of the things I've been saying are really, you know, correspond to reality. And then, of course, what is happening today is very much an opening of the minds, an opening of people's thinking to alternative ways of thinking about themselves and about the world. And that, I think, is the main effect of 2012. I don't think it's the effect of a tsunami or earthquakes or any world-shaking things, although hurricanes and all that, of course, are partly connected with the changes that we are doing in the world. But the main effect is the openness of our thinking. We are beginning to be open to each other, open to connections with each other, open even to the concept that before were used to be called only esoteric or romantic nonsense, which is the concept of love. Love as appearing as an element that physics would call entanglement. A love as an intimate connection between individual humans, showing that they are really one. So this kind of a oneness through love is an idea that is coming very strongly now to the popular mind, and is really a scientific concept put into these everyday symbolic terms. But it is, I've been saying that for a long time, and I'm saying it, and people now are saying, aha, yes, I feel that too.
So where does forgiveness fall in that? With love. So let me just read you this. Somebody wrote me a question the other day. I was one of my radio listeners, and I was talking about agape, unconditional love. So this person writes me back and says, if we take to the thesis that all we have is the moment, it's a challenge. We can be upset or in love for a moment with a change to the next. So instead of unconditional love, which might we have for the moment, it could be an emotional roller coaster. So I wonder how either for an instant or a lifetime it would be possible on this earth to have unconditional love. So I wrote back and said, It's not typically defined as love, Tom. It's the love you have for children or a puppy. So can you describe, you know, in a world that's full of anger and hate and violence, how can people have unconditional love? Can you explain that to them?
I think the greatest prophets of human history had unconditional love. I think Jesus had unconditional love. I think the Buddha had unconditional love. It grew out of understanding. These are exceptional spirits in the world, you know. But I think ordinary humans, I don't reach that level of unconditional love, but can reach a high level of love. And I think it all comes together from the whole notion that we are not radically separate from each other. If you really feel that, you are part of a community, you're part of another person, as lovers say, then you don't, you can love that other person in almost unconditionally, because you feel that it's you. Just as you love your own heart, your own liver, your own extension of your body, the other person is an extension. And therefore, are capable of a higher level of love. And that can be extended to society. It can be extended to nature. It can be extended to the universe. You feel part of it, then you have this strong sense of love. Saint Francis of Assisi had this love for nature because he felt himself very much a part of that. I think these are exceptional individuals have this high level of love born from the recognition that we are not separate. We are not dual. We are really one. I think that's the key.
So would that be equivalent, and I'm trying to say this in a manner that people that are like my brother would understand. So are you saying you love someone else, not the person that you're angry at in front of you, but love him, love that person as a soul? Love that person as a soul instead of it, somebody that's looking you in the face is angry. You love his soul. Is that an okay way to say that, what you said? Is that an equivalent?
A person can manifest it himself and herself in different ways. They're different behaviors. And if you take this behavior, then we take the symptom instead of the cause. There's some reason why other people behave like that, or anybody behaves like that, you know. Fundamentally, deep down, there is no composition, there is no contrast, there is no distinction between one person and the other, because we're all part of the same self-evolving quantum universe. I would say, as a scientist, I would say that, you see. But, of course, on the surface, we can behave in a very different way. We can be very nasty to each other. We can be cruel, violent as well. But this could be eliminated, could be mitigated by recognizing that these are mistaken behaviors on the surface. That deep down is a common psyche, a common spirit, or a common soul, if you like, for all of us.
Okay. Because you are a philosopher, and I know that you understand oneness and love, I want to ask you about forgiveness, because so many people say, I can't forgive that person. They hurt me so badly, I can never forgive them. But not personally, I don't think forgiveness means saying that it was okay that someone hurt you, but it means letting it go and not living it every day. Do you have something that you could add?
You know, there was a very nice saying. I think it was in the book, The Love Story, also in the film, saying being in love means you never have to say sorry. It's a very nice saying because, you know, being in love means loving somebody, I would say, means understanding that person. If you truly understand a person, you don't feel hurt by that person, because you feel, you know that that person has been misjudging you, misjudging himself or herself. It has been mistaken in the way that he behaves. He is not living up to his or her own nature or deeper nature. If you really love a person, you don't love or hate the behavior. You love that person, which is creating the behavior. And then you try to reform. The whole idea of forgiveness, you know, in our criminal system, if somebody does a crime, you try to punish them. I think it's a better way, but it's not always feasible, of course, is to try to understand the reason for that crime and try to reform that individual so it becomes a healthy and good member of society. The same thing goes on the individual level. Somebody hurt you? Yes. Hurt you. Try to understand and try to see how we could again reach a connection with that person which I think is the essence of forgiveness. As you say, forgiveness is not saying that it was okay. The essence is it was not okay, it was a mistake, but you are capable of something else. You are capable of loving me just as I'm capable of loving you, and that there's nothing to forgive. There's only to rectify, to help, to correct, to heal, basically. And that, I think, as a healer, I think you would understand, relate to that. That, I think, is the key to forgiveness. Try to heal instead of to take revenge.
So I'd like for you to take a few minutes and talk about loving our children. As you know, computers are everything. Everything. Cell phones, computers, iPads, iPods. And from what I see around me, that's the way parents communicate with their children. So something gets missing, touching. Parents forget to touch their children. And I want to know if you think that that's something that's lost, that's important, and that we should revisit that issue.
Well, family sentiments, family feelings, family connection is one of the most ancient elements of human beings. It comes from way before, from any mammal, any species, you know, of the kind that has children, that brings children into the world, offspring, has this family sense. Otherwise, you couldn't reproduce, you couldn't have a next generation. It's the most basic thing. And if we don't do that, if we have forego our family feeling, that means that we have forgotten our deepest inheritance of the world as a human being. Family is really as an extension of yourself. I think all of humanity is an extension of ourselves, but one's own children are the most direct extension of oneself. If you can't love your own children, there is something seriously wrong with the way you think and the way you feel.
Do you think that, I'll just rephrase it this way. I believe that because we don't put our arms around our children and touch them and sit at a dinner table, that it's contributing to violence. I read something just yesterday in this book called The Five Languages of Love, and it talks about the love gas tank or something like that. And I started looking at my child and every other child that I know and realizing when these children that act up or have behavior disorders are usually children that that never get touched and they don't ever get arms put around them with saying, I love you. They get sent texts that say, I love you. But it's different than when you put your arms around them. Something happens, you know, your heart rate changes, your pulse changes. Do you think that that contributes to the violence in the world?
Absolutely, it's tremendous. I mean, the sense of being able to put one's arm around one's children, around one's loved ones, our parents, our partners in life, you know, that sense of brings you a closeness. I think there is more to it, even if there's even a physics aspect of it. You know, you talk about the aura, you know, everybody has an aura field. It can be measured. And when you're close to somebody, your auras meet, they mingle, they join together. You can measure that, you can display them, you can even photograph them in certain types of Kirlian photography. So I think being close, physically close to somebody is a very major, very important element of being able to relate that to that person.
All right, we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. I'd like to let you have that time to say anything that you would like to say and cover any topic that we've not already covered, or even if we have, anything that you would like to reinforce. And tell people again where they can find you, please.
Well, my basic idea is that obviously we have created a world that is not okay the way it is. It has to change. Now, if you want to change the world, you have to change yourself. You don't make people change unless you yourself change. You know, like a real healer feels the other person, whereas the traditional doctor, you know, doesn't take the pill and just prescribes the pill or a treatment to the patient. We can best change the world when we change ourselves. And how can we change? We can only change if we change the way we think and we feel. To go back to the word that we have been now using for a long time to define, change our consciousness, improve our consciousness. And the new consciousness is a consciousness of connection, of non-local correction, of coherence, of oneness, if you like, a connection that is symbolized by the sense and the meaning of the word love. And if you want to change the world, you have to be capable of loving. You have to be capable of loving yourself so you can love people around you and recognize that you and the other people are not separate, not distinct. I have written not long ago, presented also on the internet and in books in various ways, a manifesto or a declaration of the new consciousness is 16 points, and I can make that available to your listeners, to yourself, if you like. But in this 16 points, I try to describe what is the new consciousness. And basically, it's a consciousness of feeling one together with the other people. And that's based on good science, it's based on quantum physics, but it's manifested in a way that everybody can relate to it. So in one word, what I think is we need to have a new consciousness, a consciousness of cooperation and not of competition, of working together with people, not with against other people, not trying just to defend ourselves, but trying to be positive to the others, forgive and learn and co-evolve. That, I think, what I'd like to say, that is my message to you and to everybody who listens to the show.
Thank you. Could you make that available, send it to me in a document form so I could post it?
I can certainly do that, yes.
That would be great. And please tell us your website again before we go, where to find you.
My new books are can be found at Akasha Paradigm. Your paradigm is D-I-G-M at the end, akashaparadigm.com, and you'll be able to access my new books. And my regular website is my name, ErvinLaszlo.com.
Thank you, Irvin. Thank you for taking the time to come on. Thank you for your patience with all of my questions. And thank you for sharing your soul with us.
Well, they are very, very fundamental questions, and your intention to change the world through changing ourselves, changing consciousness, I think it's very laudable. It's very basic, and I'm full of admiration for it, and I'll be happy to help to support that in any way I can.
Thank you. And I'd like to remind everybody that I have a new book out. It's called Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Science of Quantum Mechanics, and Irvin Laszlo is one of the chapters in my new book, and you can find it on Amazon.com or email me at evaher@gmail.com, and I can get you one. And I can actually make them available to you, Irving, if you would like to have them.
I have it on my left at this particular point, certainly.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I hope you enjoy it, and thank you. I enjoyed this hour with you.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Eva.
Good night.
Good night.